What's up, Bedford Falls? Welcome to the Jesus and Movies podcast, where we search movies for lines, scenes, characters, and themes that trace truth in the gospel. I'm Kevin Carlock. I'm here with my fellow dance floor activist, Graham Hooten, and our hope is that you'll join us on the great journey of storytelling by asking thoughtful questions about why certain movies and moments resonate or don't resonate, and what they might say about the movie, about you, and perhaps about humanity as a whole. Today, we're talking about It's a Wonderful Life, and Graham, my one question for you is, what does it mean to have lived a wonderful life?
That is a good question, Kev, and I think the fundamental question that this movie is trying to ask, and what this movie says is that, again, no man who has friends is a failure, right? And I think there's some things to be affirmed there and some things to be critiqued, but really, it's such an incredible film. I'd never seen it before. This is my first time, and so I'm really excited to be reacting with you on this podcast this morning.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead and just spare me the wait. What was it like to watch it for the first time? I am just itching to
know. So honestly, I don't really watch a lot of old films. I don't know anybody who really watches a ton of old films unless you're super kind of old movie historian, Casablanca kind of person. And so I just was blown away by how relevant it still felt. And whereas Elf, what we did last week, is so much about commercial Christmas and modern Christmas and, you know, New York City and the glitz and the glamour, this feels a lot more about the heart of Christmas. And yes, it is a Christmas film, but also most of this movie doesn't take place during the course of Christmas. And so I found myself really emotional at points, just learning from George Bailey, learning from the people in his life. And I was talking to my dad last night. I'm like, we got to watch this as a family. I think especially in a really hard year where there's felt like so much brokenness and hopelessness in the world, there's something really deeply inspirational and touching about It's a Wonderful Life and talking about how we show up for people in the midst of broken situations and how we sacrifice for ourselves and how there's actually hope that God redeems those moments and those situations that often feel really unredeemable. So in short, I absolutely loved it. And when I have a family one day, I want to make this a Christmas staple of mine.
Oh man, you don't have to say that because I love it. It's my favorite Christmas movie of all time. It doesn't have to be yours too.
No, I mean, I know you set a pretty high standard for me. You're like, I think you're going to love this. And I genuinely really did love it. It just felt so rich to me. It felt so rich.
Yeah. I think a lot of these themes are deeply biblical, right? Character instead of consumerism and unfulfilled dreams, unappreciated sacrifice, humility, faithfulness, trustworthiness, meekness, generosity, community building. A lot of these things are super biblical. And honestly, kind of in an era of big superhero movies where it's a little bit of like who can have the biggest flex, this is really kind of the opposite of that, where it's how lowly can I be, and does the small, intimate, seemingly trivial moments of life and relationship building and ministry, does it matter for anything? Does it actually go anywhere? Mm-hmm. Or is it just a colossal waste of my time and effort?
Yeah, I think whereas a lot of films would kind of pose the question, man, I wish, or what would it be like if I could be like a superhero? What would it be like if I could be like this incredible person this movie is about? Really, George Bailey is George Bailey because of the choices that he makes with his life. And so we're kind of offered, directly or indirectly, the opportunity to participate in the same life that he is living. And there's nothing, yes, there are like some really great qualities maybe that are inherent to George, but we kind of get invited to participate in living the same life that he is living. I think that's the invitation of the director here. And I just love that.
Was there anything you didn't like about the movie?
We'll get to False Prophet later. And I think there is definitely some false messaging in the film. It's also a little bit longer. And I don't know, structurally, it just felt a little bit, I wouldn't say it's bad, just different than most of the films that we've watched so far in terms of the flashbacks and maybe the narration, but I don't have any large complaints about it. What about you?
I think it's interesting that you said it's longer. It's actually only 2 hours and 10 minutes long, and that's with credits, but I agree that it feels long because I think the third act really drags a little bit. As necessary as it is to revisit George's past, it does feel slow to me. Mm-hmm. And I also don't love the voiceover narration, getting the stars lighting up, Joseph, all of that stuff. I just think there's a little bit too much of that kind of in between. I find myself wanting to go back into the story and not really feeling like I'm learning much from those little mini intermissions. And then I really don't like the part that you mentioned, like no man is a failure who has friends. The themes should be felt by the audience. They shouldn't be explicitly told from the movie makers to the audience through a notebook at the last scene of the movie. You know what I mean? So that's kind of like a cardinal sin of movie making, I would argue, is when you sort of like force the audience to take away a line instead of letting them draw their own conclusions and having sufficiently told the story in a way where they feel the conclusion that you've made them feel.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I think also the third act, there's a lot of redundancy. Like, he just can't seem to come to the realization that he doesn't exist in this world.
Yeah.
Which is probably reveals a little bit more about his ego more than anything, but it feels like they kind of hit the same points over and over again. Whereas the temptation scenes, again, him with Potter over the course of the first and second act, feel a lot more character building, a la Jesus in the desert. I feel like the third is just kind of hitting, it's kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, it's tricky though, because like we need to spend a sufficient amount of time in the past for us to genuinely want to be back in the present tense and to really feel grateful for having made it back too. So it's tricky, but yeah, I'm with you. Well, should we hit some awards?
Let's do it, Kev.
Give me your Lazarus Award for the high key gospel moment in It's a Wonderful Life.
So my Lazarus Award goes to the community giving scene at the end of the film.
Mary did it, George. Mary did it. She told some people you were in trouble with it. They scattered all over town collecting money. Didn't ask any questions, just said, George in trouble. And tell me, you never saw anything like it. Spread like
fair. Another run on the bank?
And Mr. Martini, how about some wine?
The fool flew all the way up here in a blizzard.
Carrie, how about your banquet in New York?
Oh, I left right in the middle of it as soon as I got Mary's telegram. Good idea, Ernie. A toast to my big brother George, the richest man in town.
So this is my favorite scene, and it's also my Lazarus Award for a number of reasons. There's so many I could go into it, but we're going to try to keep it relatively brief. What happens here is that George has spent his entire life in Bedford Falls giving back to his community. He has sacrificed his own honeymoon. He has sacrificed his dreams to go out and travel the world. He has sacrificed his own personal financial stability. And in this moment, we get to see people from the community, people that he has shown up for time and time again, show up for him, dumping out their change jars, pulling money out of their wallets, people who don't even have much to give, emptying it onto a table, followed by a $25,000 gift from Sam, who sends it from overseas in Europe to cover all the expenses. And what I love about that specifically is that it's $8,000 needed to cover all the expenses, and yet those expenses are covered 2, 3, maybe 4 times. We don't even get the final count of the money. And people come joyfully giving the money in order to serve the person who's been serving them this whole time. And I think this, for me, is a Lazarus Award because it's such a clear depiction and representation of what the church is supposed to look like. What I immediately thought of in the verse that came to mind was Acts 2:42 through 47. This is the early church. After the ascension of Jesus and the apostles are trying to figure out how do we live out this idea of Christianity in our day-to-day lives, it says, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. That is the kind of community that I want to be a part of. That is the kind of community that the church is supposed to be, that the kingdom is supposed to be. And in this moment, we get to see the entire town packed into the Bailey's living room, celebrating, drinking, cheersing, and ultimately singing Odd Lansing. How do you pronounce that?
Auld Lang Syne.
Auld Lang Syne together. And it's such a beautiful and emotional moment because the people who have been receiving actually get the opportunity to give, and it's so joyful. And so, yes, we got Acts, but we got a couple other verses. Luke 6:38, given it will be given to you, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For the measure you use it will be measured back to you. Again, laying down one's life allows us to receive the kingdom in even greater capacity. Not that it is based on merit in any way, but in some ways, giving is our gift as we get to receive the goodness that God has in that. And finally, Mark 12:41-44, this is the story of the widow who brings two pennies to the temple courts. Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in two very small copper coins, worth only a few cents. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in everything, all she had to live on." Is this not such a great picture of the kingdom that it's not about, hey, I need to get tithe 10%. It's not about, hey, I need to give to a certain amount of charities. It's not even like, hey, I need to give this portion of my life to ministry and service. This woman is all in. She doesn't have anything to offer, but she brings everything. And the cool thing about the kingdom is that everybody can afford it, but it also costs everything, laying down our lives and realizing that, hey, this is not about me. This is about serving Christ and seeking to imitate him in my life and impact the world around me in that. And so I think this is a fantastic scene. There's so much going on here, but that's why this scene wins my Lazarus Award.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think when we talk about picking awards with our head versus our heart, this is definitely the hard pick, right? Like this last scene is kind of the most heartwarming scene in the movie by far. This is like your one glimpse of redemption that you kind of don't get throughout the whole movie. And you took it in a different direction than I would if you went with the early church as kind of this prodigal, kind of giving of everything mentality that everybody seems to have. I always have seen this scene as more of like getting a glimpse at kind of the yield or the output of what has been an entire lifetime of giving. Although I agree with you, like you said, there's obviously some false teaching here, and we'll dive into what it means to put on your own oxygen mask before you assist someone else later in the pod. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about maybe the elements in which George is kind of getting a glimpse of the effect of how he's made choices throughout his life and sort of, oh, maybe it was kind of all adding up to something.
Yeah, I think that's what Clarence is trying to do with George, especially in the third act of the film where he takes him throughout the town in Bedford Falls, which isn't even Bedford Falls anymore. It's what, Potterville?
Potterville,
and he gets
yeah.
to see Potterville. He gets to see that the world is actually a worse place in so many ways. Like characters are in jail. Characters are homeless. Characters are angrier because he is not present. And again, it comes to fruition in the final scene when he gets to see the joy that other people get to experience because of his ministry of presence. I love that. Is truly a ministry of presence. This is a deeply incarnational ministry. All he did was live in his small little town that he wanted to escape. He served and he cared for people well, and he ran a small local business. And there's so much dignity and beauty in that, which he goes on to probably understand more. That was one of the things he critiqued his father for, and yet he ultimately kind of becomes a lot like his father in that way. So I think in terms of ministry, when we look at our lives, we often don't get to see the effect that we have on other people. And not that in any way our value is tied to the ways in which we affect other people. But I think this is a really cool glimpse at the fact that our lives matter. Like our lives of incarnational ministry, of just showing up and seeking to serve God and know the kingdom and bring it here on earth. Like we often feel a lot more like seed planters than harvesters. And yet here he gets a glimpse at the harvest and realizes that, you know what, like my life here has great value and it's not for nothing.
What is incarnational ministry?
Incarnational ministry, I mean, that's what Jesus did. Like it's going to a place and dwelling there and just being there as a person. And so like that's when we talk about John 1:14, the word became flesh and dwelt among us. Like that is incarnation, like God incarnate in the person of Jesus came and dwelled among people. And so if we are to believe that we ourselves are vessels of Christ. Like, if we believe that the Holy Spirit is in us, we get to show up in places and dwell among people, following in Jesus's footsteps. And that's what incarnational ministry is, more so than seeking to evangelize or preaching. And yes, these are good things, but really our incarnational ministry is the ministry of presence. And I think that's what George does really well. He's simply present among people.
Got it. Any last thoughts on that epic scene?
Love the closing song. That brought tears to my eyes. I just found out that All Glory Be to Christ was only written like 6 years ago. And I really love King's Kaleidoscope's version of it. And so I was like, oh, All Glory Be to Christ. It's not that. It was a song that was written in the 18th century. So what do I know? Another thing.
Hey, maybe it doesn't have to undermine the song that you love. Maybe it adds a richer tradition of history behind it.
I think so. I like to think so.
I'm giving my Lazarus Award to George defending the Bailey Building and Loan from Potter. So this is a tussle, as the movie says, between the Baileys and Potter throughout the entire movie. This battle for the Bailey Building and Loan, this tiny little people's bank, is kind of like the one remaining institution in Bedford Falls that the avaricious and successful Potter hasn't gotten his hands on. This scene happens early in the movie, and I think it really captures the spirit of the battle that takes place throughout the entire film.
You know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him, but to you, a warped, frustrated old man, they're cattle. Well, in my book, he died a much richer man than you'll ever be.
I'm not interested in your book. I'm talking about the building and loan.
I know very well what you're talking about. You're talking about something you can't get your fingers on, and it's galling you. That's what you're talking about, I know. Well, I've said too much. You're the board here. You do what you want with this thing. There's just one thing more, though. This town needs this measly one-horse institution, if only to have some place where people can come without crawling to Potter. Come on.
So I think George articulates really a vision of the local church really well here. And maybe in different ways that you kind of talked about the local church in your Lazarus Award, because you were sort of talking about how everyone can kind of give and sort of buy into something that's bigger than themselves and maybe not be quite as consumeristic, but really be participating in a body. This is a little bit different. I think the Bailey Building and Loan parallels the local church in that it's this measly, broken down, unattractive means by which God faithfully heals and tends to his people. And we really see that with the way the Bailey family interacts with their so-called clients. You know, oh, I can vouch for him. I know him. He'll pay it when he can. And not to say that, like, this is how I think business ought to be done or whatever. I'm just saying that I think the institution of the Bailey Building and Loan functions a lot like the institution of the local church in the way that it deals with people, treats them as human beings, gives them the sense of equality of humanity and a sense of dignity, and really is kind of customer first. It's really not like, how can I make a nickel or a dime off of this person? It's really like, do you have any idea how long it takes a working class person to save $5,000? Like, they need this loan. They need it now if they're ever going to have a chance of escaping the slums or whatever. And I'm going with Ephesians 3:10 to start. I've got three verses. This is Paul writing, "So that through the church the manifold wisdom of God might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places." Romans 12:4 through 5. This is a little bit more of what you're talking about. "For as in one body we have many members, and the members do not all have the same function, so we, though many, are one body in Christ and individually members of another." So there in that verse in Romans, those two verses, you kind of see that sense of sort of parts of the body, but all one body. And I think that works really well for the bank, right? Because this is an especially great parallel in my mind, because a bank is kind of the foundation of any economy or society. It's really like the fundamental building block. Like, yes, Bedford Falls can have a shoe store or it can have a movie theater, but what you really need kind of on a grassroots level to get a society going is a system of money exchange, the ability to loan, lend, things like that. And really, when we think about America's founding, it was really the issue of a centralized bank that really was kind of like your key political litmus test. Like, when we think about the great, I know you and I both love Hamilton, but the kind of the biggest difference I would argue between Hamilton and Jefferson politically is like what they wanted out of a bank. Like, Hamilton wanted a really strong centralized bank because he felt that the federal government needed to be strong enough to be able to do things that could get the economy going in young fledgling America, whereas Jefferson really loathed the idea of an incredibly powerful bank and was more into states' rights. And so all of that is to say that it makes sense to me that the bank would really parallel the local church well here, because it's kind of like this institution where you have Ernie is a taxi driver and he's involved with the bank, and Bert's with the police and he's involved with the bank, and Violet, you know, does her thing and she's, and so you're kind of capturing everyone from different walks of life. And that's basically what the local church is, right? It's everyone has their own lives, but that we all submit to this body that's beyond ourselves. And so that's why I think the bank has an especially helpful element to the parallel here. But really what the heart of this award is for me is just how small, how meek, how faithful this tiny little bank is, and how it represents the one thing that Potter cannot get his hands on. And that leads me to my final verse, which I think is the strongest for this parallel. This is Matthew 16, 18. And there's kind of a lot of controversy behind this verse. We'll talk about it after I read it. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. So this is Jesus speaking to Peter and to the disciples, and he's saying, the gates of hell will never prevail against my church. And that's kind of my parallel here. The controversy is over, like, is he saying Peter is the rock of the church, or is he saying, like, the gospel, or is Jesus himself, you know? And historically, the Roman Catholic Church has said, no, Peter is clearly the rock of the church. He's building it on the disciple, later Apostle Peter. Whereas the Protestant interpretations over the years have been much more muddied. Some people think it's Peter. Some people think it's really the gospel. Some people think that Peter is like standing in for the disciples, and Jesus is kind of speaking to all of them as kind of the first Jesus followers of sort of the new covenant era. And so whatever you think that is, Jesus is saying, like, hell will never overcome the church. The Bailey building alone is going nowhere. Potter will never get his hands on it. Even, and as despicable as you think the little rundown church is in your neighborhood, wherever you are listening to this podcast, like, God has chosen the local church as the mechanism by which he will faithfully tend to his people. And it feels a lot like the Christmas story of Jesus being born in a manger, you know, no room in the inn with the cattle. Like, is this really the grand plan for the sovereign God of all eternity? Like, is this really the prophet, priest, king that's been promised to us? He's going to be born in a manger through, you know, Joseph and Mary? Like, what's the deal with that? And that's a lot of the local church, is kind of this major underdog story of, like, this? Like, I look left and right at church and I'm like, these are the people? This is the place where I'm supposed to be cared for, you know? Don't you just kind of feel that sense of, like, are you kidding me? Like, this is what it's about? And I think the Bailey Building and Loan really captures that.
I love that. Do you think there's any differentiation to be made between Little C Church and Big C Church here in the ways in which we see the kingdom?
Yeah, I should have defined that. So when we talk about church, we sling that word around all the time. Capital C Church, it's a people, not a place, right? So the body of believers, all Christians everywhere, when we talk about church. And even within that capital C Church, there's a visible church, and theologians will say there's the invisible church. And so what we're talking about there is the people that we think are believers versus the people that only God knows to be believers. That's the invisible church. And it's a lot like the remnant in ancient Israel. If we look through Old Testament, we see that, like, Israel is God's chosen nation, but that doesn't mean that everyone in Israel is saved, because not all of them are, you know, obeying the Lord and, like, wanting to know, or, you know him. And so there's the invisible church, and then there's the visible church is like the circle outside of that. But anyways, Little C Church being like the local church, that's like, you know, I go to this church on this street in this city, and you go to that church in that street in that city. And so that's a different kind of church. So hopefully that was clear.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, it makes sense.
Was there something you should add there?
No, I think you kind of nailed it. And just, I think one of the great things about this era is that it feels like the power of community and the power of local feels so much stronger than it does today.
In the It's a Wonderful Life era, you mean?
In the It's a Wonderful, yeah. And just, you know, even today we have commercial banks, and, you know, my bank is in Chicago and I live in North Carolina. And so we kind of get that community element removed. And, you know, obviously there's a push to support small businesses and shop local and be a part of being ingrained in our community. But in some ways, technology and commercialism has just fragmented our society. And so really the hope, I think, is that the local church gets to be that community, the core upon which everything else is built, even though it often doesn't look like that. So I would say that's a challenge in our culture today.
Totally. I mean, this movie definitely is all about sort of highlighting the strengths and weaknesses of small town America, right?
Absolutely. Well, I love that Lazarus Award. I think there's a lot to be affirmed there.
There's so much to talk about. I could talk about this for days. I love this movie, and I love the Bailey Building and Loan. Take me to your Mary Magdalene Award for a low-key gospel moment in It's a Wonderful Life.
My Mary Magdalene moment is the Charleston contest / pool scene.
Oh, get hype, baby. That's like our intro as my fellow dance floor activist.
Kev, I won't lie, I miss the dance floor these days. I know we've been in quarantine for like 9 months, but one day we're going to get back out there.
We're going to light it on fire.
That wasn't you.
Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes, the big Charleston contest.
I love this scene because it's George and Mary dancing at this Charleston contest at this high school dance, and there's this giant gym floor, right? And underneath this gym floor, apparently there's a pool, and some of the guys go and try to prank George, and while they're in the middle of this contest, George and Mary are dancing back and forth, and George is like, I'm not a good dancer, but Mary apparently really is, and they're kind of killing it, and the ground begins to open up, and we see everybody else freaking out and cheering, and George and Mary are like, they must just really love us dancing. Little do they know, they're just on the edge of falling into this pool underneath them. And ultimately, they fall into this pool, and everybody thinks it's going to be this incredibly embarrassing moment, but George and Mary continue dancing. And not only do they continue dancing, other people in full tuxedos and dresses follow suit and dive in alongside with them. I love this scene. I think it's such a great picture of what it looks like to capture childlike joy in dancing in the midst of horrible and embarrassing and tough situations. But really what I want to center on here is that George doesn't care. He is being literally undignified before his entire community. And so what I pulled from here is 2 Samuel 6:16 through 22. This talks about David. And David is worshiping the Lord. He is with the Ark of the Covenant, and yet one of his people seems to have an issue with that. It says, as the Ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the Ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person and the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women. All the people went to their homes. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in full view of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people, Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." I love this because he is totally being called out by a woman in power who's saying, like, you are completely making a fool of yourself in front of all these people. You're not even like fully dressed. You are dancing around. Honestly, she might be like, hey, people think you're drunk or you're just like on something crazy. But really what he's doing is worshiping and dancing before the Lord. And I love how he responds here. It's like, I will become even more undignified. I will make more of a fool of myself because I love and I like understand the Lord's love for me that deeply that it just simply brings me to the point of wanting to rejoice. And so I think that's what George is doing here and Mary as well, like becoming even more undignified before a crowd of people because his identity is not rooted in the fact that he needs to look good around other people. He just simply has this childlike joy that is instilled within him. And you see the ways in which it affects the people around him. Like, I love the idea of somebody in a full tuxedo jumping into a pool because they just want to be a part of it. Again, great contrast in this scene, like really high life, high society life and really undignified life, and here those two kind of come crashing together. And what a great picture of what it looks like to follow Jesus here. And I also want to pull from Genesis 50:20-21. This is a story of Joseph and his brothers. This is after Joseph's father Jacob has died, and Joseph has been elevated to this high position in Egypt, and his brothers, you know, are like basically cowering before him. They're like, "Please show mercy on us. And we know we threw you into slavery. What are you going to do?" He says, Joseph said to his brothers, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I'll provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. What a great turn for Joseph here. The fact that he's showing so much grace to the people who tried to harm him. And while it may have been intended that, again, his brothers wanted to throw him into slavery and harm him, like, he turns around and makes good out of that and gets to celebrate what God is doing in the midst of that. And similarly, while the prank may have been intended to humiliate George and Mary consequently, he actually gets to turn that around and use it as celebration, as a almost a worshipful joy, and other people join in. So that's why this wins my Mary Magdalene Award.
Yeah, I really like it. And you already know this because we actually talked about this one beforehand, but I like the last element that you added about sort of what man intended for evil, God actually used for good, that kind of Romans 8:28 idea, like he's going to work all things for the good. With Joseph, I guess my one critique is like, it was almost for, I don't know if it was the way you read it, or it almost sounded like what Joseph's brothers intended for his demise, Joseph was like cunning and wise and disciplined enough to kind of turn around and use it for his own good. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like he has the agency there, whereas I would argue sort of
Philippians
like...
Philippians
4:13a. Yeah, exactly. A classic.
I can do all things.
Exactly. Regardless, I'm giving my Mary Magdalene Award to George crying in the living room right after Uncle Billy lost the $8,000.
Listen to me. Think.
I can't think anymore, George. I can't think anymore. It hurts.
Where's that money, you silly, stupid old fool? Where's that money? Do you realize what this means? It means bankruptcy and scandal and prison. That's what it means. One of us is going to jail. Well, it's not going to be me.
What's the matter?
Nothing's the matter. Everything's all right.
Come on, Pete. You're a big boy. You can get this star up way up at the top.
There it is, dear.
All right. Fill in that little bare spot right there.
Isn't it wonderful about Harry?
Well, famous, George. Bet I had 50 calls today about the parade, the banquet. Your mother's so excited.
And so, while everything seemed to be all right in the world and in the Bailey living room on Christmas Eve, something was deeply and terribly wrong. As George's wife Mary decorates the tree, his daughter Janie practices piano, and little Tommy covers George's head in silver tinsel, George can do nothing but weep in his secret, terrifying knowledge that the whole wide world is moments from being ripped apart, that every good and beautiful thing in this living room is hours from death and destruction. George is on the Titanic, and he's the only one who knows that it will soon be at the bottom of the Atlantic. And all he can do is sit there and squeeze little Tommy with every ounce of worry and stress and shock and fear at what's to come. And writers call this the dark night of the soul, typically at the end of Act 2 or in a similar location. This is like the part of the story where sort of like all hope is lost, like it seems like there's no way back. You know, everything is gone. In myth stories, it's usually like the heroes like descending into literal hell or like facing darkness. Other people call it like the gate, the gauntlet, visit to death, if you're a John Truby fan. But anyways, like this is the darkest night. This is the lowest minus that sets up the highest plus ending that we can possibly have. And so the biblical parallel for that darkest moment of the story, the dark night of the soul, is the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus really defined this concept of the dark night of the soul when he possessed the secret and terrifying knowledge that he too would have to go to jail as punishment for missing the $8,000, but that this jail, Jesus' jail, would be a cosmic prison of eternal, divine, infinite separation from the person and being of God. Jesus would descend into hell itself for his death and atonement for our sin, and the disciples had no clue what was going on the night before. So decorating the tree, practicing piano, spelling out frankincense, and tossing up tinsel on infallible perfect daddy's head, they had no reason to suspect that Jesus' incredible life and ministry could possibly be in any kind of danger. You know, you're the chosen one. What do you mean? Like, you're not going to die. But Jesus, too, was on the Titanic all alone and knew that he had but hours left. And so Matthew 26 tells this story. picking up at verse 36, "Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I go over there and pray.' And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, 'My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me.' And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will.'" I find that so powerful, Graham. My question for you, is Jesus here praying that he would not have to die, that God would change his mind?
I think what we get to see here is a great example of what prayer looks like. It's a conversation with the Father. Jesus is coming before him incredibly genuine, right? Being like, hey, this is not what I want. Like, this is not the path that I have chosen. And yet, in the midst of that, submitting himself to God's will, like, not my will, but your will be done. So really, like, Jesus in that moment, I don't think really wants to go to the cross. Like, it's not what he's itching to do, but at the same time, there's a deeper, I guess, submission to the Father and, like, belief that what God has for him on the cross is actually what's best for all of humanity.
Yeah, and I think at the same time that Jesus says, you know, at the end of the day, not my will, but your will be done, I think he is really asking genuinely, like, God, could there be a different way? Listen to Mark's version. "And they went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I pray.' And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, 'My soul is very sorrowful, even to the point of death. Remain here and watch.' And going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, 'Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but you will.'" So Mark gives us even more detail on Jesus begging God, please, there's got to be another way. Like, surely there has to be another way. I'm not going to actually die. Luke 22 says that Jesus' sweat was like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. Yeah, so I think that's kind of what I see going on here. George Bailey sweating blood in dread of the death that he knows is coming, that only he knows is coming, while the disciples sort of slap him on the back and sweetly dream in the pleasant garden, not a worry in the world.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, that's why, and sorry to bring this up, but UMBC, 16 seed beating number one Virginia, it's like, it's why that is such a great upset, right? Just because, again, it's the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. And that's why, again, why Virginia's championship in 2019 was so much greater, right? Like, experiencing the greatest loss, the most embarrassing loss, and yet conquering the greatest victory. I mean, shout out Jesus in college basketball.
Yeah. And one thing that's really interesting, like, my family and I watch this movie every year, and it's always kind of regarded in my family as a really sad movie. Like, It's a Wonderful Life. Ugh, are we really going to drag ourselves through that this year? Like, it's so much, so heavy. And it is. And, like, this is the deepest point of that heaviness. This is the dark night of the soul. And yet this movie is also really redemptive and really hopeful and ends on such a high, high. And so I'm always curious by any kind of art, whether it's movie or, you know, music or art that kind of has, like, a really, really, really low story at the same time that has a really, really high story. Because ultimately, I think that's really the gospel, right? Like, the gospel is, like, the toughest tragedy, but it's also the most redemptive story of all time.
Yeah. We're all just trying to recreate the greatest story ever told.
Yeah. So take me to your False Prophet Award for something non-biblical in It's a Wonderful Life, a non-biblical argument that this movie makes.
So I think the false prophet here is actually one of the clearer ones and one of the more prominent false prophets that we've dealt with over the course of this podcast. I'm giving my False Prophet Award to the idea that no man is a failure who has friends. This is kind of the closing line we get from Clarence. He writes this in Mark Twain's book that he ends up giving to George. And really what he's trying to communicate in this ending scene is that George's value is rooted in the fact that he is valuable to other people. Again, George's output to the community and the ways in which he has impacted people means that he has a life that is worth living. I mean, there's a lot to be affirmed here in the sense that we get to have real impact in the communities we get to live in. We have relationships wherein other people are changed. Like, that is ministry at its core, relationships wherein we get to rub off and other people get to rub off on us. And yet, that's not where our true value is. God doesn't say that we are valuable to him because we go and impact other people. He doesn't say that our goodness is rooted in the fact that we might do ministry or we might serve people or we might treat others with dignity. It's rooted in the fact that we are made in his image. So Genesis 1:26-27, a verse we talk about over and over again. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. We are created in God's image, and there is an inherent goodness tied to that, something that not even sin can take away from us. The reality that we are image bearers of God, and we are created, as Ephesians 2:10 says, like, we are created in Christ Jesus to do good works. We are God's masterpiece before we go out and do anything that is good or worth value. 1 John 4, 9-10, "In this the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. In this is love, not that we have loved God, but that he first loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins." Look, we get to see that God loves us first before we get to go and love other people. Here we kind of get George's storyline is kind of reversed in the sense that he goes and loves other people, then he experiences love. The gospel story is that we are loved first. Out of that love and the grace that we have received, we get to go and bestow that love and grace on other people. And I think some people's stories, I think mine very much, kind of is more George-like in the sense that we go out and do good things because we've been told that we're supposed to do good things, and along the way we discover that grace is first meant for us more than anybody else. But I think really that's like the false idea of how the gospel works, that we get to participate in the goodness that God is doing, not to try to earn goodness, but because it is who we are at our core. And so George's value is not based on his large sphere of influence, and I think that's what the movie tries to communicate. And so that's why this is my false prophet award.
Yeah, I totally agree. The sequence is backwards. It's the classic, you know, works versus faith. If I am valuable to my community, then I can feel good about myself, right? That's the antithesis of the gospel.
Absolutely. So let's take it to you. What is your false prophet award?
Almost the same, similar. I said George's salvation, kind of generally like how he is saved in this movie. So sort of that same ending sequence. So one, there's the living rescue, and then two, there's the moral rescue. So one, his living rescue, like the plot, like how does the money actually get paid? Good character saves you in the end. Like in this case, good character earns you the generosity of friends, and then they pay the debt that you can't pay. But you're the reason that they're friends with you, so really, like, you saved you. You know what I mean? Like, George was a certain kind of person, and because he was a certain kind of person, they were able and willing to pay him back in the end. So it was kind of like he ultimately saved himself, whereas in the gospel, you know, it's not an $8,000 debt. It's an $8 million debt, and every penny in Bedford Falls put together won't come anywhere near paying it. Someone has to go to jail. And so that's part one. Part two is the moral rescue. That's what you talked about. No man is a failure who has friends. So what if you don't have friends? Are you a failure? Can you be redeemed? What about Potter? And, you know, we're kind of quick to think Potter could not be redeemed or whatever. And like the gospel is a totally level playing field where salvation is by grace alone. It's by God's proclamation that we are good. You know, that's what you said. It's not because Adam and Eve have merited any kind of goodness. It's because God has said, "I have made you, and I declare you good." It's fiat, right? It's divine proclamation. He defines goodness and evil. So I think the gospel antithesis to Clarence's line is, friends are nice, but when it comes to salvation, it doesn't matter how many friends you are, because a dead person needs a resurrection to experience any kind of life. We're born spiritually dead. You might have a few skeletons laying near you, but like, let's be honest, someone's got to reach down into the ocean floor and drag you up and breathe life into your dead lungs, and you can be born again. And that doesn't happen through having friends. It happens through supernatural external intervention. So the verse I picked here is 1 Corinthians 15:21-22, which I think you'll see the cool parallel here. "For as by a man came death, by a man has also come the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive." And he's not saying all will be saved through Christ. He's saying, like, as death entered through one person, life exits through one person. Kind of the same idea we see in like Romans 5. But I think what's cool here is the Adam parallel to Jesus, because it's like the Garden of Eden, like where everything went wrong. And then the Garden of Gethsemane, where everything began to become right. You see that parallelism in the gospel story between like Adam, humanity's fall in the garden, versus Jesus and humanity's ultimate ascension in Christ in his garden. So I think it kind of ties back into the Mary Magdalene Award. But yeah, I think there's a really deceivingly charming argument the movie makes here, that like if we just have friends, it's all worth it in the end, and you know, our friends will come through for us. And really, George has saved himself by having built up such a strong reputation and trust with all these people.
Yeah, and I think the reality is, like, are these people doing it out of love, or are they doing it out of the fact that they owe him in some ways? And I think, like, the gospel would argue that, like, true giving is because, like, you are genuinely loved, not because you are owed something. And I do feel like It's a Wonderful Life communicates the fact that people in the community genuinely do love George, but I would agree with you in the sense that there's a lot of false prophet here, because we can do nothing to ensure our own salvation, no matter how good we behave in the world.
Yeah. And so I don't want to be too condemning, because this scene is also your Lazarus award. So, yeah. Like, let's be honest here. Like, there's so much biblical truth here. It's just we're constantly trying to put ourselves in that framework of affirm and critique. What is biblical about this? What is not biblical about this? You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of parsing out to be done in this scene.
Yeah.
So take me to your Jesus award for the most Christ-like character. And I got to say, I've got a gut feeling.
Yep, for me, my Jesus Award has to go to George Bailey. George does so much over this film, it's kind of hard to narrow it down, but really what he does is sacrificially live out a life of loving other people and putting other people's interests in front of his own. And we get to see that in its full joy come to fruition in the end, and we see the impact that he has had on the world around him. So there's a number of verses I could have gone with here, but I'm going to go with Ephesians 5, 1 through 2. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. Philippians 2, 3 through 7. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who, being in the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And that's really what he does here. And so that's why I think George gets my Jesus Award.
That is a good segue. I also picked George. So first I'll go general and then I'll go specific, because I think the big picture is revealed in the details and the specific most of the time. Generally, I associate George Bailey with humility, sacrifice, community building, kindness, equality of human worth, dignity, really biblical, wholesome traits. Specifically, though, when I think about George, it's that constant laying aside of personal aspirations. Specifically for him, it's travel, careers. He wants to build big buildings. He wants to do big things, go on big trips, and experience kind of a new life outside of Bedford Falls. But the laying aside of all that to help with Bedford Falls is needy and desperate. And so I think we see this reflected in our most cherished Christmas hymns. Hark the herald angels sing, mild he lays his glory by. Like, Jesus sets his glory aside. Come thou long expected Jesus, leaving riches without number. He's like casting all of his wealth and glory and status aside, leaving them to come find us. And then because I can't help myself, John Milton in Paradise Lost, me for him, life for life I offer. On me let thine anger fall. Account me man. I, for his sake, will leave thy bosom, and this glory next to thee freely put off, and for him lastly die well pleased. This is Jesus, the Son of God's proclamation to God the Father in Book 3 of Paradise Lost, that Jesus is going to take God's wrath instead of humanity, that he's going to cast his, you know, glory aside. He will leave thy bosom, and this glory next to thee freely put off. And George does this over and over and over, and I actually wanted to know how many times. So I counted five. One, not going to school to run the building and loan. And that's kind of the clip with Potter that we played at the beginning. Two, not going to school once Harry returns, because Harry, his brother, has bailed on running the building and loans. So George is going to have to actually keep doing it instead of their initial agreement to trade after 4 years. Three, not going on his honeymoon to quell the run on the bank. That's obviously a really big one, a really clear insight into George's character. 4, not getting to serve in the war because of his deaf ear. That's not really a huge one. Maybe that counts as like half, but he still has to like kind of stay behind. He doesn't get to go anywhere. And then 5, going to jail in Billy's place when Billy's the one who lost the $8,000, right? So all of this, I was looking for like a good verse of like a, you know, whether it was like a promise from God or like a anecdotal series of verses where we sort of see like a story in which someone is kind of doing this. But I never really found like a great one, but honestly, I just kind of ran out of time in my preparation. But here's Deuteronomy 34. I settled on the death of Moses. And this is like, Moses has lived this pretty profoundly compelling life of leading the Israelites out of Egypt and helping them to establish the tabernacle and basically the new rule of God over his people, right, in fledgling Israel. And he doesn't get to go into the promised land because he disobeyed God. And so this is kind of the death of Moses. This is the final chapter of Deuteronomy, super short. Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, all of Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the Negeb and the plain, and that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as the Zor. And the Lord said to him, this is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there. And so Moses doesn't get to enter, but he gets a glimpse of it. And I think in a lot of ways, like this final scene, the one that we've been talking about throughout this podcast, is George getting a glimpse of the promised land. But, you know, ultimately this life is just that. It's a glimpse, but it's not the promised land itself. And so I don't know if Moses is really a great parallel for the sense of sort of constantly laying aside our own desire to kind of do what God has for us, because in a lot of ways, Moses gets to like leave Egypt and go on the journey, whereas George is constantly pinned down to Bedford Falls. So maybe like David is a better parallel in some ways, being the shepherd boy. But you as the listeners, come up with your own parallels, write us, email us, and come up with a better one. Because I think what's really Christ-like about George throughout this movie is how he lays aside his own aspirations to tend to the immediate pressing needs of the community.
I think that's great. I think, we talked about Moses and leaving the promise, or not actually getting to experience the promised land himself, but really, like, Moses is just a small picture of Jesus, right? Like, Jesus is the one who is the ultimate sacrifice award. That's why it's called the Jesus Award itself. So,
yeah. And if we have more time, I'd like to dive into complexity here, because I do want to say that, like, I don't necessarily think it's always the biblical thing to just like put your own desire aside and just immediately help the people in front of you. I think I've really changed in my thoughts about that over the last several years. Like, I think there's an argument to be made that the biblical decision for George Bailey is to leave town in some of these instances. I think there's definitely a great conversation to be had there about God doesn't need us, you know, like he chooses to use us, but he doesn't need us. And therefore we don't have to shoulder every passing burden of everyone else,
right?
You know? So I think there's a lot of complexity here, but I do think in the run on the bank scene especially, and then taking blame for Billy's loss is very Christ-like. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's any argument that George Bailey isn't my Jesus figure here. I just think there's an argument that we don't need to feel like we have to be like George Bailey to do what God wants for our lives.
A little Enneagram 2
definitely
critique, right? Like the, like, hey, I don't need to be like everybody's
exactly
everything.
And George kind of is like everybody's everything. And I think there's a lot of things about that are not biblical.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be said there. That's it for the awards, and now onto the Q&A. But first, an announcement. Need new running shoes? Want to support a local business? Omega Sports sells running shoes and a variety of athletic apparel and equipment both in stores and online at omegasports.com. For online orders of at least $90, they offer free shipping everywhere, and use the redemption code JIM for Jesus and Movies. Doing so gives you 10% off your purchase and gives another 10% towards our production costs. So if you're looking for a Christmas gift, again, that's omegasports.com, code GIM for a discount and to support us. Yeah, so guest submissions, a new part of this podcast we're really excited about. We started an email, jesusandmovies@gmail.com. You can send us something that you've written or you've seen God reveal himself to you and something you watched or read or listened to. And that can be just writing or it can be an audio file. And in this case, we've got our friend Bess McLawhorn, who sent in this audio file, and we'd like to play it this week as an example of how God has revealed himself to someone and what they watched, read, or listened to. So check this out.
Hey, everyone. My name is Bess. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I'm a big Jesus in Movies fangirl. My parallel is a Jesus in TV shows, one that I've been watching during quarantine called Dawson's Creek. It's a show from the 90s that follows six friends through high school and college. There's a lot of romance throughout the show, and I'm choosing a moment between main characters Pacey and Audrey. The couple has some miscommunications that lead to Audrey at the airport about to leave and move on, and Pacey chasing after her. In his hurried state, he bribes the security guard to grant him access to the airport's intercom to confess his feelings to everyone. He says, and I'm paraphrasing it a bit here, "Audrey, it's me, Pacey, on the intercom. I don't know if you can hear me, but please don't get on that plane. But know that if you do, I'm going to drive all the way across the country and stand in front of your house until you talk to me, because I need to tell you that I'm truly sorry for everything. The only thing I want to take away from this year is you. I think you're amazing, and I just want to be with you." This grand gesture made me think of God's overbearing, overwhelming, public, and genuine love for us. The scripture I have is Zephaniah 3:17, which reads, "The Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you by his love. He will exult over you with loud singing." God rejoices over us so much so that he's willing to run into the airport to chase us down and blabber all about how great you are on the intercom for everyone to hear. It's cheesy 90s TV, but I do love the idea of God the Father making an announcement at the airport.
That's great. Bess, thanks so much for sending that in. I haven't actually seen Dawson's Creek. It has been recommended to me, but that sounds like a great kind of textbook, explicit gospel, Jesus relentless pursuit moment. Graham, thoughts?
Yeah, again, I've never seen Dawson's Creek, but I think what Bess is doing here is exactly what we're hoping that other listeners of Jesus' movies are going to do. Like, hopefully, through listening to this podcast, you get the tools or maybe the verbiage to go and find the gospel for yourself in pop culture and music. And hopefully we get to have this podcast be a platform where we can share those things with one another. So it gives us great joy to be able to see you guys finding the gospel in things that you are consuming, and so keep sending them in.
Right, because above all, this is a methodology more so than a finished product. But again, just for logistics, that's jesusinmovies, all one word, at gmail.com. You can just send us a note. It can be really short, or it can be really long, like you do you, or it can be an audio file if you want to, you know, be able to hear your voice on the pod. So it's up to you. But that's really helpful for us. If you have feedback, you can let us know too. And it's also a great place for Q&A. If you know, hey, we're going to do Moneyball in 3 weeks, and that's my favorite movie, and I want to write in something that I want you guys to talk about, email us, jesusinmovies@gmail.com, and we'll be sure to talk about it. So this is direct access.
It's the tabernacle.
This is the tabernacle of Jesus and Movies podcast. I don't know about that parallel. I'll have to think on
the
that.
Holiest,
but anyways, yeah, shoot us an email. So sadly, we have to stop the discussion there. But before we close, here's a quick shout out to all of our supporters on Patreon who make this discussion possible. Andy Simmons, Ben Dunbar, Bess McLawhorn, shout out to you. Clay Young, Courtney Carlock, Craig Carlock, Graham Hooten, Helen Webster, Jacob DeRizio, Janet Hooten, John Pabone, Ken Hooten, Kristen Carlock, and Mike. Thank you all so much for your support. Our monthly production schedule is posted on our Instagram at Jesus Movies. January schedule coming soon. Give us a follow and a like so you can see what movies are up next. And if you'd like to support the Jesus Movies podcast, Patreon is our preferred way of support. For $1 a month, you can become a patron and help pick the movies, submit questions for the Q&A, get shouted out on the podcast, and featured on our Instagram. So if you'd like to join the group, please do so at patreon.com/JesusAndMovies or on the free Patreon app. Lastly, if you're listening on Apple, give us a review and let us know what you think. It helps us to learn more about what's working and what isn't, as well as to reach new people. So if you're listening on Apple, we'd really appreciate a review. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jesus Movies podcast, and we hope you found some goodness, truth, and beauty. Know that Jesus pays not our $8,000, but our $8 million debt, that he will never let the Bailey Building and Loan go out of business, and that communal, Christmas, all wrongs righted celebration is but a glimpse of God's long-awaited kingdom. We'll see you next week.